Okay, any preliminary questions or issues? I have I'm just preparing this condensed outline, which I will provide you with tomorrow. I'll also post it on my website in case you're unable to make it to class tomorrow, or if you want to download it electronically to play around with. And then next week, we'll revert to questions and answers. So essentially, we'll take the entire coverage of the first three chapters and invite you to ask questions about points that are still hazy in your mind, and or as you look at past exams and you have difficulty figuring out how it is that the sample answer arrived at a particular conclusion or failed to reach some point, that's a good point of departure as well. Again, the goal for next week is to kind of synchronize your outline, your understanding of the material and mine, so that we're on the same page together. Any questions about procedure or the like? Okay, well then we are set to go, I think, with Fine versus Permanente on page 108. As I said before, it's kind of a logical segue from the material on allegedly excessive awards to the legislative efforts to restrict awards, and that in turn provokes constitutional challenges questioning whether the legislature is completely free to change what historically has been the method and measure of compensation. And as I said last week, it is not my intent at this point in your legal education to make you experts in this particular area of constitutional law, but at least have some feel for the kind of arguments and also the way in which the courts, in effect, produce mixed responses to these constitutional challenges. As we'll see, some courts find the challenges persuasive and overturn the tort reform measures. Other courts, as we will see, find that the questions are ones best left to the legislature. So, can somebody tell us about Fine versus Permanente and Simpson. Gave him some Maalox and sent him home. Right. I don't know that that happened, but I suppose it did. Okay. What was the amount, roughly, of the economic damages? So by the time we get done, it's roughly $800,000. Okay, in economic loss, lost wages, medical expense, and so forth. But there's also a non-economic award. And what's the amount of that non-economic award? This is the point in contention here. Was the judge required by statute to reduce this to the maximum of $250,000, or was the effort of the legislature to restrict these kinds of recoveries a violation of some constitutionally protected right? Now, the plaintiff offers three challenges to this statute, and let's take them one at a time. What's the first one? Actually, that's the second one. The first one was equal protection. Okay, and where is the right to equal protection located in the Constitution? Yes. So in the so-called post-Civil War amendments, 13th, 14th, 15th amendments, an important change took place in the structure of the Constitution. Prior to then, lots of cases arose about constitutionality, but most of them involved questions about whether the federal government had exceeded its authority by claiming powers that didn't belong to it, Marbury versus Madison sort of thing, or by infringing upon some protected right, free speech or the like. But up until the 14th Amendment, it was never assumed that states were in any way limited in the way they could treat their citizens. So, for example, there were cases of freedom of religion where someone living in New Orleans complained that their right to a Catholic burial or funeral had been abrogated by the city of New Orleans. And the federal court responded by saying, in effect, you don't have any... The Constitution says nothing about a state's ability to affect religion. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. And maybe the other branches of the federal government can't do anything about religion, but the state can do whatever it likes. And everybody sort of nodded their head and said, well, of course. Comes the 14th Amendment, however, the post-Civil War amendments, it says no state shall deprive people of the privileges and immunities of citizenship or of the equal protection of law or of due process of law. So for the first time, states were limited, aside from their, you know, prohibition that they can't print money or raise an army or other kinds of things, but the idea that an individual could sue claiming that a state had taken away their constitutionally protected rights, that arose for the first time again after the Civil War. So the structural change in the Constitution now raises the question, okay, what may a state do and what may a state not do in light of the constitutional guarantee that the state can't deprive you of equal protection of the law? Now, the way this has come to be interpreted, what is it that equal protection guarantees, or to put it the other way, what does equal protection forbid? What does the Equal Protection Clause forbid a state from doing? That's the plaintiff's claim, but as we put that claim into context here, we have to figure out how has the Supreme Court described the contours of this Equal Protection Clause? Let me just say that the opening kind of argument in an Equal Protection Clause challenge is, I'm being discriminated against. You're treating me different. You're not giving me equal treatment. Someone else is getting treated differently compared to me. And as it turns out, the legality or illegality of this discrimination depends upon, well, what kind of discrimination? On what basis are you being treated unequally? And that makes all the difference in the world. So that some kinds of discrimination are okay, or at least we scrutinize them at a very low level. Some forms of discrimination have to pass essentially through the eye of a needle before we will permit them. Now, what is it that is the most closely scrutinized kind of discrimination? But again, if we're looking at the Equal Protection Clause and we're looking at treating people differently, well, if you fall into this category, you get this treatment. If you fall into that category, you get that treatment. What kind of categorization sets off the most alarm bells in terms of saying, well, wait a minute, on what basis are you doing that? Racial discrimination. It's not to say the state is never permitted to treat people differently on the basis of race. After all, the whole affirmative action debate says there may be a place under certain circumstances for saying, you know, this discriminated group needs to benefit from certain policies that will enhance diversity, et cetera, et cetera. It may be that when we get to the end of it, we say, well, yeah, there's discrimination on the basis of race, but it has... We give it this strict scrutiny, and we require the state to give us a compelling state interest that is narrowly tailored to achieve the result. So again, that form of discrimination or other fundamental rights that, you know, ethnic discrimination or religious discrimination would be permissible if the state can provide us with this really compelling reason and to say, in effect, this is the only way we can achieve this compelling state interest. By contrast, there are other forms of discrimination that say, for example, if you drive a truck that weighs less than 10,000 pounds gross vehicle weight, you're subject to this tax category, but if you drive a truck that has more than 10,000, weighs more than 10,000 pounds, you pay a different rate of tax. Well, that's discrimination based on the size of your truck. But we say, yeah. Any kind of governmental policy that rewards people who grow corn but not wheat, or rewards people, you know, there are all sorts of discrimination that the government engages in to qualify people for some things and disqualify other people. Now, as it turns out, there's something in between, and this case doesn't talk about it because the law wasn't as developed at that point. It turns out there's something called intermediate scrutiny, which is, I believe, the only category that has been placed in intermediate scrutiny is gender or sex-based discrimination. And the most famous case, you probably remember it, is the Virginia Military Institute case, the VMI case, where the state of Virginia said, we need our military academy to be restricted to males. We can't admit women and still have the VMI we've known and loved. And the court, adopting or applying this intermediate scrutiny test, says it's not the highest level of scrutiny, but it has to be an important governmental interest that is closely related to the method chosen. So the state of Virginia tried to persuade the court, look, it just wouldn't be the same place if we had women at VMI. Here, all, you know, we have these. We have another place that women can go, and that's really okay, isn't it? And the Supreme Court said, no, we're not persuaded. That's not the interests you have put forward are not strong enough, or at least the method you've used of excluding women is not closely enough related. We're not buying. So they failed that intermediate scrutiny test in the BMI case. But now, at the lowest level of scrutiny is so-called economic regulation. Again, where we say, if you drive this kind of truck, you know, you get this treatment, but, you know, glass bottles have to be recycled, but plastic bottles you can throw away. All sorts of, when you begin to think about it, again, government all the time discriminates in favor of things or against forms of behavior that are, again, treating people differently based upon whether they do something that government likes or doesn't like. Unless you can demonstrate that the basis of discrimination falls within one of these more protected categories, you're stuck at this bottom level, and what's the test the court applies to see whether or not the statute is constitutional? Yes, or a rational basis test. Does the statute have a rational basis? Not whether I agree with it or not, whether I think it's good public policy, but rather whether or not there is some reason, not even one necessarily specified in the statute, but some conceivable purpose that would form a rational basis for this statute. So again, the level of scrutiny that is given to those kinds of cases is very low. Now, the first thing we need to figure out is, how is Mr. Fine being discriminated against? Who's getting better treated than he is? What about somebody else in California, who's being treated differently? But somebody who's being treated better than Mr. Fine. Otherwise similarly situated, he says, but I'm being discriminated against. What's the rule being applied to him that's not being applied to other people? Yeah, if the defendant in this case had hit him in a crosswalk and caused him these injuries, and the jury says, these are your damages, he'd get an unlimited recovery. He'd get his full damages, instead of which, in effect, because he's the victim of medical malpractice as opposed to negligence on the highway, he's getting his recovery cut down according to the statute. So he's being discriminated against, okay, but again, does he fall into some protected category? Is this on the basis of race or gender or some, you know, religion or some other protected category? No. All the legislature has to, again, and the legislature doesn't even have to supply it, the defendant or the defender of the statute only has to propose a hypothetical reason for this statute's existence, which would form a rational basis. What is the basis, according to the defendant, for the legislature's enactment of this MICRA? Okay, so you see this rise in premiums for medical malpractice. The defendants say this is caused by runaway jury verdicts. We've got to put caps on those verdicts so that malpractice premiums can return to normal levels and we can continue providing good medical care. What's the plaintiff's response to the claim that this legislation was necessitated by a health care crisis. Yeah, the plaintiff actually can provide pretty good evidence that the reason for the sharp rise in premiums has less to do with the amount of jury awards and a lot more to do with the investment climate. That the way insurance companies make money is they take your premium dollars today, they go off and invest those dollars, and you know, 3, 4, 5, 10 years from now, they eventually have to pay out some of those premium dollars to insurance claimants. In a buoyant economy, you can charge low premiums and make so much money investing those premium dollars that even if you have big bills to pay later on, you'll have made enough money on the investment that you come out ahead. By contrast, when the economy flattens out and the premium dollars I take in today are pretty much the same amount I'm going to have to, I'm not really going to make much money on them. I may even lose a little bit of money, and I'm going to have to pay out on jury verdicts 5 or 10 years from now. I'm going to have to charge a lot more today in order to break even. So what has changed is not necessarily the size of jury verdicts. It's what's going on in the investment world. And if the plaintiff argues to the court that this the jacking up of malpractice premiums had precious little to do with jury verdicts and had everything to do with how much money the insurance companies were making in the investment world, then what? What's the court's answer to the plaintiff's argument that this is an irrational reason to limit the size of jury verdicts? Yes. Yeah, I'm just a judge here. I don't rule on the wisdom of the legislature. My goodness, that would land me in very deep water, and would be horribly depressing. Besides, you know, if I could only sustain those acts of the legislature that passed my standard of good public policy, I have to trust that the people's representatives in the legislature are making what the people believe is sound public policy, and so long as there is a rational basis for it, I have to give the people what the people want. Okay, so again, to the extent that the court looks at something like this and says ours is not the reason why, ours is but to do the will of the legislature, fine. If there's, you know, as the court points out, debatable the point may very well be, but that doesn't mean that it's our job to judge the quality of the debate. If you field a debater, if you've got somebody who makes an argument, however stupid the argument may sound, you've passed the test of having a rational basis. Now, to be sure, courts from time to time do not find that there is a rational basis. And I believe in the Massachusetts case that was just decided, it was decided on the basis of a rational basis test, and the court found a rational basis lacking. And again, I believe the decision of the Massachusetts court was 4-3, so there were a number of judges who said, gee, I find not only the arguments to be a rational basis, but I find them persuasive. Again, a court has to, in the end, say, well, what do we believe qualifies as a rational basis for legislative action or standard? So, again, the plaintiff in this case was unable to persuade the court that this statute was so lacking in rationality that they could strike it down as a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. If you were able to upgrade your status to a different level of scrutiny, to say, I'm the victim of discrimination not on the basis of some kind of economic regulation, but because of my gender or because of some protected category like race or ethnicity or religion or the like, then you can force the legislature to justify its action by a more compelling sort of standard. Okay, so equal protection doesn't work. What's the next argument? And again, this is also found in the 14th Amendment right after the Equal Protection Clause. So in addition to being guaranteed the right to the equal protection of the laws, you're also guaranteed due process. What does that mean? Okay, and it turns out, just as we have this body of law, you know, the 14th Amendment doesn't talk about strict scrutiny or rational basis. The 14th Amendment simply says equal protection, and the courts have fashioned a body of law to explain what that is, how that's going to be carried out. Similarly, with respect to due process, the court has developed this standard to say that the right to due process kicks in when yes, and you the first thing you have to do to make a due process argument is to show there's a property right that I enjoy that's been taken away. And for example, one of the things that people will say that I have a right to my job, and somebody took my job away without providing due process. Well, you know, to what extent is your employment a property right as distinguished from, you know, just a relationship to which, which either party could walk away from at their choosing? Now, his argument in this case is, what's his property right that he claims has been taken away? Well, actually, there's another issue with respect to that. But the legislature essentially said, no, you're not entitled to $500, as the jury said. You're only entitled to $250,000. He says they took away my right to full compensation. What's the court's answer to him on that point? But can they take away his right just because, you know, if you all decide that it would be a lot easier to get around in Spokane if you build a highway through my backyard, you can't just say, well, we've all decided this would be good public policy, you take my property. You've got to go through a procedure before you do that. Why is it that the legislature can haul off and say, Mr. Fine, the most you're going to get out of this is $250,000 in non-economic damages? Why are they justified in doing that, according to the court? Why isn't this a violation of due process? Yeah. He lacks this property right. And while he can say, in some sense, I had a right to compensation and you took it away, what the court winds up saying is, with respect to tort compensation, these are all matters, in effect, of legislative discretion. The legislature could choose to expand tort liability and make people strictly liable for driving on the highway. The legislature could decide we want no more tort cases arising out of automobile accidents, and we're going to kind of workers' compify automobile travel. And so-called no-fault insurance is a kind of step in that direction. At least for some kinds of claims, you're told, in effect, don't sue the other guy. Collect your own insurance to compensate yourself. This may be good public policy, it may be bad public policy, but the court's idea is that the legislature chooses the boundaries of tort liability, and if they decide to expand it or contract it, no one can say, in effect, but you took away my rights. Again, I think we've talked before about the fact that once upon a time there was the tort of alienation of affections. So that if you broke up someone else's marriage other kind of relationship, you could be sued for alienating affections, and that was viewed as something that was compensable. And then with social changes and other kinds of developments in the law, people said, well, that's kind of a bad idea. We don't want to do that anymore. And no one could say, but you took away my rights. You could say that in a kind of abstract way, but from the standpoint of due process or preventing the legislature by constitutionalizing the right to compensation, the court said, in effect, no, you can't do that. So, again, due process doesn't work because there's no property right that's been infringed. We have a third constitutional argument here. Okay? And how does that go? Okay. And in effect, what the legislation does is to take what the jury would have given, $500,000, and substitute something different, $250,000. And therefore, the jury's will in this case has been replaced by the legislature's will. Is that okay? To the extent that you would say that the jury's fundamental role in this process has been sidestepped or trampled upon, you might say, well, gee, this doesn't really respect the right to trial by jury. But part of the difficulty for the plaintiff is that you could prove too much with the argument. That is, if the jury got to do whatever it wanted, then you could say, well, no court can restrict the jury's right to hear hearsay evidence, for example. Or the jury, if it wants to, should be able to award punitive damages. No, we have very structured rules as to how cases are presented to juries and on what terms. And we give them the law. Going way back to the turntable case at the very beginning, we kind of allocated these responsibilities that the court determines what the law is, and the jury then applies that law to the facts. So that sort of image means that it is not for the jury to say what the law is. They're given the law. They only apply such law as is given to them to the facts. On the other hand, suppose the statute said the judge will now decide questions of liability and the amount of damages, if any, but the jury shall determine whether the plaintiff or the defendant was better dressed. And that was the extent of the jury would render a verdict like that, and that would be recorded in the court file. Well, you would say, huh? And it was, you had a right to a trial by jury. We gave you a jury. Don't you remember? You know? Well, no, that would be ridiculous. The jury can't be reduced to a spectacle. It's not that you have 12 people sitting out there and deciding they really like the plaintiff or the jury needs to have some meaningful role in the process of adjudicating whether the plaintiff or the defendant wins the case. So, you know, if the defendant is saying that the only right to a jury is to the spectacle and the substance is not implicated in the right to trial by jury, well, that would suck all the air out of the right to a trial by jury. On the other hand, if the plaintiff's argument is, in effect, the jury is the proverbial 600-pound gorilla that gets to sit wherever he wants, well, that can't be true either. The jury has to be contained, has to be directed, has to be instructed according to what the law is, and they have to take an oath to follow it. So we're kind of lost here as to what exactly is the scope of this right to trial by jury and the extent to which we can reduce it, tweak it, crimp it, and still have honored the right to trial by jury. There would come a point, obviously, at which you say, no, legislature, you've gone too far. But this, at least according to the court, isn't there yet. All we've done is we've changed the measure of damages. And if this were unconstitutional because it infringed upon the jury's unfettered discretion, well, then you couldn't do anything to affect the way juries behave. So, again, it's a kind of a mushy middle here, and the court actually doesn't go even into that much detail, but you can see the way in which the claim to an infringement of the right to trial by jury doesn't lead to a direct kind of analysis. I make reference in the notes to this Washington case of Sophie versus Fiberboard, where they relied upon a state constitutional provision that said the right to trial by jury shall remain inviolate, and the court said that cutting down non-economic damages, they didn't have an arbitrary cap. The statute made the non-economic damages a function of, they could only be a certain percentage of the economic damages. And I forget how the formula worked. But because the state constitution, I should add here that many times the arguments about constitutional provisions are not necessarily about the federal constitution. They may be about a state constitution, either a state constitution that contains parallel provisions, or it may be a unique thing, for example, the Washington statute, that doesn't simply say that everybody has a right to trial by jury in certain kinds of cases, but it says this right shall remain inviolate. It suggests that there is a kind of special scrutiny for preventing the jury from exercising its discretion. You could give them a different standard, but one of the things that's kind of undesirable about this formula or this way of proceeding is that instead of saying, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you may award as much as $250,000 in non-economic damages, the jury is given the impression that they are awarding, you know, $500 here and $800 there. And then in the back room, somebody takes a pair of scissors to this award and trims it up so that the jury is essentially being treated like a a problem child here, not being treated as though they were applying the law to the facts. So again, the whole question about not only what freedom the jury has, but the way in which the jury is being treated, whether in effect respectfully or disrespectfully, may make a difference in terms of the way the court evaluates. But we get to the end of the day, and basically, the plaintiff's arguments about constitutionality have fallen on deaf ears, and the court says it's a legislative question. Maybe this is good public policy, maybe it's bad public policy, maybe it's just good lobbyists from the insurance company. We don't know. We don't have the authority to make a different call. All right. Questions about... fine. Again, we'll come back to this in Chapter 7 when statutes of limitation also restrict plaintiffs' recoveries, and they are challenged on the basis of constitutional protections, and in one case, they're challenged successfully. So we're by no means done with the interplay between reform efforts and constitutional challenges to those reform efforts. Now, collateral source benefits. Schoenberger versus Roberts. Again, a statute. Here, though, we're not looking at a challenge to its constitutionality. It's a somewhat unusual challenge, in effect, to the way the trial judge responded to the evidence about workers' comp benefits. Can somebody tell us about Schoenberger? Mr. Viviano. Okay, and here's this scenario. We have a plaintiff who is injured by a defendant. The defendant is asking for compensation from that defendant, but as it turns out, there is money coming, in this case from workers' comp, but it could easily be any other third party, where there's money going to the plaintiff. What's the defendant's request of the court? Right. The defendant says, I'm liable for the difference between what the plaintiff's already received and the amount that the plaintiff needs for compensation. Now, let's go back before the statute. The statute comes, again, in response to a perception of a problem. But before the statute, the common law rule with respect to what are these are called collateral sources. The reason they're called collateral is they're unrelated to any defendant's liability. That is, if you, for example, had another defendant, say in an asbestos case, and you settled with one defendant or got a judgment from one defendant and made them pay, coming from another defendant, that's not a collateral source. But when it comes from your own insurance or from some government disability plan or something of the sort, that's considered a collateral source. So again, prior to this statute, what was the court's response to the argument that a defendant should be able to reduce his liability by the amount the plaintiff had already received by way of compensation. Why? But there's usually some kind of rationale for a rule like that. Why would it ever make sense to let the plaintiff get more money than he needed? Yeah. Okay, there may be a kind of deterrence function here. That is, that we want to make sure the defendant doesn't get away with something. But why isn't the plaintiff getting a windfall here? An undeserved windfall. Yeah. They may. I mean, this is not something that we always can count on, but frequently, particularly in the case of insurance, let's suppose you live next to Mr. Menlove in Vaughn versus Menlove, and he carelessly builds his haystack, it burns your house down. You immediately go to your fire insurance or homeowner's insurance. They pay off. You rebuild your house. You go to sue Mr. Menlove, and he says, what compensation? You got your house built. Why should I have to pay? Now, as it turns out, if you read your homeowner's insurance policy, you will find, I would bet, 99 times out of 100, buried in the boilerplate of your homeowner's insurance is a paragraph that talks about subrogation or talks about claims against third parties. That if you are entitled to collect for this loss from some third party, you agree, first of all, to help the insurance company sue that person. You may be happy to have your house rebuilt by your homeowner's insurance. They want to get reimbursed, however, and they will ask you to cooperate in a suit against the defendant so they can get reimbursed. But if you get reimbursed by that third party, according to your insurance contract, you've got to pay it back. So far from having the plaintiff double dipping here, the plaintiff has to pay this back anyway. So when the defendant pays the plaintiff, everybody will come out even. Even if that's not true, suppose I get injured and my Aunt Susan sends me a check for $10,000 and says, you know, I'm so sorry to hear you got hurt. I want to make sure you don't have to worry about money. You know, please use this to get better, and I hope you get better soon. I don't have to pay that back. But should the defendant be able to reduce his liability to me and in effect get the benefit of Aunt Susan's generosity? Or should I get the benefit of Aunt Susan's? If somebody's going to get a windfall here, it makes a lot more sense that the plaintiff be the beneficiary of the windfall than the defendant. So the answer, again, to the common law, the reason for the common law rule was, first of all, there may not be a windfall because I may have to pay it back. And secondly, even if there is a windfall, better the windfall go to the plaintiff than that the defendant take advantage of the insurance premiums I've paid or my Aunt Susan's generosity. Okay, so that was the common law rule. And so the collateral source rule, before we ever get to a statute, would say, pay no attention to that man behind the screen. Ignore the fact that the plaintiff has been or will be compensated from some other source. Make the defendant pay as though there were no other source of compensation. Then the plaintiff will sort that out later on. Along comes this statute, and the statute says what? Okay, so that it provides the same thing by statute as your insurance contract would provide through mutual agreement, namely my receipt of compensation from the third party requires me to reimburse, in this case, workers' comp, for what they've paid me. You may draw the jury's attention to the fact that look at the fact that the plaintiff is being compensated from another source. So it reverses what had been the rule, and the question is, do you say aye, sir, and salute the legislature, and you say we admit this evidence, fine, you're the boss, or does the court say, no, this is crazy, we can't do that, makes no sense. And that's where we'll pick up tomorrow.